Good evening. So I want to talk about Zazen. I was struck recently, a friend of mine that I practiced with at San Francisco Zen Center many years ago, a man named Darian, I'm not sure, Rehezazad, I think, close enough, and he now lives in Tehran. He's Persian. Anyway, he practiced with my teacher. We share Sojin Mel Weitzman Roshi as a teacher, and Darian writes to the Berkeley Sangha periodically just about what he's doing and so on, and he wrote just recently an email about a passage that he was going to talk about. He has a small sitting group in Tehran, and I haven't asked him. I mean, every time I say that, I think, really? And he lives a pretty normal life there, I think. At any rate, he has compiled for himself a book of quotes from Sojin Roshi. And this was from a lecture that Sojin gave probably a long time ago. And what struck me was that the way that Sojin talked about practice, I guess we'll do, kind of like how we live our lives. And he talked about having a karmic approach or a dharmic approach. And we talk about this a lot in different ways. We can talk about it as kind of the relative daily life of suffering and confusion and the life of the absolute in clarity, if you want. The distinction that he was making was something like that. He was saying, you know, karmic life is the life that arises out of our choices. Karma technically means volitional action, choosing action, the exercise of will. I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like. I will, I won't. And it arises out of attachment to the idea that there's something, some separate self here that I want to be permanent and that I need to protect and I need to express out into the world. And in the process, of course, we create suffering for ourselves and others because we're acting from a self-centered place. And when I say self-centered, I don't necessarily mean that's terrible. It's just kind of we're hardwired for that, right? That's how we know to do it. And we have to make choices. We have to express ourselves. We have to decide what to have for breakfast. Most of us, it doesn't appear by itself. And a dharmic approach is one that arises out of no self, no greed, no delusion, no hatred. When we simply let go and, I'm going to say, get out of the way. Get out of the way of the myriad dharmas expressing themselves. As the Genjo Koan says, when they come forth and experience themselves, that's liberation. And that's difficult. We do. It happens. And it happens more in Zazen. I mean, that's a way of understanding Zazen, isn't it? Zazen is just letting go and coming back here. Letting go and coming back here. And sometimes in Zazen, there's no need to even let go. There's just being here. There's just breath breathing. It happens. It happens. Sometimes it happens a lot. A lot of the time, instead, our effort is to let go. Oh, I was thinking. Oh, I mean, you don't even have to do that. Oh, I was thinking. Right? You notice when you're thinking, and the fact that you noticed means you're present again, so you just keep breathing. And sometimes you get to breathe for quite a while, and sometimes you get right back on the train, and then you notice that, and then you let go of that. And there are times, I hesitate to say this, but I'm going to say it. I think, you know, when you have a habit of sitting Zazen, when you sit Zazen a lot, when you sit sesshins and one-day sittings and so on, when you do retreats, living from a dharmic place comes easier. The gesture, you know, there's a wonderful book by Uchiyama Roshi called Opening the Hand of Thought. And I, when I first heard that title, I didn't understand it. I liked it anyway, but I didn't really get it. But what he means is so much of our thinking is grasping thinking. So holding on to something. And what if we can open that hand and just let a thought be a thought without an I'm thinking or I like that thought. I mean, we think like, don't like constantly, but we don't say those words to ourselves. It's just virtually automatic. But the more we sit Zazen, my experience is that it gets easier. Not necessarily easy, and there are times when it's really hard. It's just plain old hard, and you're upset about something. Something didn't go your way. Somebody hurt you. You hurt somebody else. You know, things stay with you, and it's hard to just let them go. And one of Mel's points in this lecture was that it isn't that these things don't happen. It's not that things aren't difficult sometimes. It's not that things don't hurt. It's not that anger does not arise. But what changes with dharmic practice is that it gets easier to not get caught by it, to not get so tangled in it. That if you're sad, to just be sad without adding drama to it or without complaining. Why did this happen to me? Which is ironic. We say that kind of thing when somebody died, you know, somebody that mattered a lot to us and it's hard and we're missing them. And then I get pissed off. How could you do this to me? And I had some of that when Sojin died a few years ago. The difference is that I knew it. And I knew it for what it was. And it was a bunch of things, one of which it was selfish, self-centered, but and completely normal and natural. So just I let the thought arise, let the feeling arise. Cry if that's what's coming up. It's the getting entangled with this stuff that's the problem that we create. You know, we say sometimes that, you know, pain is going to happen and suffering is extra. Suffering is optional. And we, you know, those are just words because they sometimes get used the exact opposite way. It doesn't matter. The point is that, you know, when your teacher dies, it hurts. And what you don't need to do is add extra onto it. You don't need to make it about you, for example. And if you do, which I did some, you know, whoop-de-doo. I didn't get tangled with it. I didn't beat myself up about it. I just figured, well, how could you? You know, and I kind of laughed about it. I told him before he died, I've told Reb this too, that they're not allowed to die. I told Blanche too, so much, though that's two out of three are gone. So, oh well, Reb is 6 months older than I am. So we'll see, he's almost 81. He'll be 81 next month. So this dharmic realm, I see it as my practice as this sort of bottom of the ocean kind of thing. So there's the karmic realm, maybe is the choppiness on top, but at the base, below that, it's pretty still. And the choppiness doesn't bother me very much. I can't say it never bothers me, but it doesn't bother me nearly as much as it used to. And it doesn't last as long. And I often can just accept it. I think really we live, those of us who practice and are aware of the dharmic approach, aware of this deep letting go, this deep loving connection. We have that deep water, and we live in this karmic world. We do, we make choices all the time. We have preferences all the time. I don't like jungles very much. I like high desert. That's okay. I like some people more than others. I like some dogs more than others. My problems arise, and our problems arise, when we take that like and dislike too seriously. When we, Alan Sinaki, maybe they still have this bumper strip on their car, I don't remember that. Anyway, don't believe everything you think. Don't believe everything you think. Can you remember? Can you remember not to believe everything you think? The more that we practice, the easier that is, the easier it is to not get so entangled. And to go ahead, be willing to live this life, to have preferences, to make choices. You don't have a choice about that. Every time you open your mouth, you're making choices. You choose which words to say, what tone of voice to use, how loud. We have to do that. It's if we don't, if we can't, and then we use sign language. Somehow we communicate, and somehow we make choices. Most of us. If you're in prison, you don't have a choice about what you have. But well, then you have ramen in your cell, I guess. But at any rate, I'm picking nits saying that. I say sometimes we live in this relative world, this karmic world, this world of liking this better than that, wanting, not wanting. We live here, but with the mind of the karmic world, with the mind of emptiness, I'm trying not to say ground, because I was already using ocean, but I want to say it's grounded. And the trouble with all of this is there's no way to talk about this. So you just do the best you can, right? How do you talk about stillness? We practice, and as we practice, we do tend to loosen our grip on our sense of self. I was just reminded of this the other day, some meeting with teachers that I meet with regularly, and I know that this doesn't matter. I don't know why I'm... Oh, it was at a book group, and somebody was reading a passage in the book, The Kite Runner, which is really, I commend it to you. The movie doesn't come anywhere near. I thought I had read it, and then I did read it, and it turned out I saw the movie, which was nice, much nicer than the book. At any rate, there was a passage where this man had suffered a lot. Finally, and then he had a parallel experience, and he realized that forgiveness and self-forgiveness had finally come. And somebody, I don't know what, I can't forget how he misinterpreted it. There were six people at this table, right? And he said, and I don't understand, that doesn't sound good to me. Something like that, you know. And everybody at the table said, what? That's exactly how it works. It's exactly how it works. And it reminded me of my own experience. And I think of this as what I like to call a fruit of practice. You know, you can't practice in order to get more of the karmic realm. You can't practice to get the mind of emptiness. That's exactly how not to do it. So you just practice. You sit up straight and you watch your breath and you let go of thoughts. That's it. So easy to say. But at any rate, years ago, my parents... My mother was an alcoholic. My father had multiple sclerosis. My mother had cancer. My mother was demented. And And I felt, in my late teens, early 20s, I felt like my family knew from suffering, and you did not know from suffering. If you started talking to me about how your mother broke her arm, I'm not usually say this out loud, but inside I would think, you have no idea what family suffering is. You have no idea. Don't even talk to me. That's how I would feel inside. I would just feel really resentful and imposed upon. How could you understand? And then one day I was at the Berkeley Zen Center and I was leaving, and I wouldn't even tell somebody that whole list at any one time because I thought it would overwhelm them with the terribleness of it. So I'd tell them 2 out of 4 or something, I don't know. At any rate, I don't remember how it came up, but I was just leaving and there was a guy that was out in front washing his car, and we started talking, and I, for whatever reason, I mentioned this list of troubles in my family. And he said, yeah, you know, every family has its mishigas. And I said, yeah, and I kept walking, and I was halfway down the block, and I thought, I didn't get pissed off. I did not feel that he was minimizing it. I had no extra reaction. And I thought, I was just thrilled. I let that go. Does everybody know what mishigas means? No, if you don't know what mishigas, it's a stew of troubles, let's say. Crazy troubles. Will that do? Is that a good enough definition?
Craziness.
Yeah. It always seems so... I don't know if it's onomatopoetic. Anyway, just the word itself, sort of like mish or mush, you know, this mess. At any rate, that was a fruit of practice. I never practiced in order. I never really thought about it as as my problem, or that I was attached to my family's drama. But when he said that and I just responded, yeah, and walked away, I realized I was really attached to that, and I'm not anymore. You know, not that way. And that those things happen, but they just happen. And that's what we were telling this man. It isn't about whatever he had. So I don't remember what his idea was, but we were all saying, no, that's how it happens. When something in you that's been a difficulty changes and lifts or changes in some way, and you experience some liberation from it, it just happens to you. Now, I would say for us, it happens because we practice, or at least in part because we practice, because we intend to sit zazen, we intend to end suffering for ourselves or others. We intend to loosen our grip. And we sit zazen, and we see how tight we're holding on to some things. Certain thoughts tend to keep coming up. And then you learn, oh, this is a habit of mind. You don't have to label them. You don't have to think about it. And they keep coming up, and eventually you notice, oh, I keep having this kind of thought. I define myself by that this kind of thought. Oh. And maybe we start paying attention to what it feels like in our gut when this kind of thought comes up, and it feels yucky. And then I say to you, stay with it, feel it, don't think about it, feel it. And then see what happens over the next 6 months to 10 years. I don't know. There's no guarantee about this stuff. I think we really must find a way to live with these two facets. But our effort is to let go of our clinging and let go of our greed, clinging, hatred, aversion, and delusion, just confusion. And find a way to live in this daily mishigas, but without getting so caught by it, without getting so entangled. And then knowing when we get entangled, and then having the courage to sit still with that, and then hopefully see it lift. But no demanding, no asking for it. It's hard. I think it's hard. It's hard to let go. Sometimes it's not. I don't want to say always, but a lot of times it is. And you don't want to get tangled with that. You know that you should let go of X or Y. But you can't, it doesn't work to insist. I mean, I started to say you can't insist. You can insist. You can torture yourself for the rest of your life if you want. But it's not useful to insist. And I want to change the subject because I want to talk about something really fun and remind myself and us, the summer's coming on and it's going to be really hot, of course, but it's also, you can go up to Folsom Lake and go swimming. And you can swim in the rivers. All kinds of wonderful, wonderful things. And it's really one of the ways we need to remember about our practice is to enjoy ourselves. To, in the words of both Robert Aitken Roshi, who was one of the founders of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and Thich Nhat Hanh, they both advocated recreation, recreation, that you need to have time when you just enjoy yourself. And that's, I think that's really, really important because you can get attached to practice in some formal practice. And forget that there are times when you need to go for a walk. And what I wanted to say is, I just came back from a road trip of 3 weeks. So I just took 3 weeks and did nothing but drive and walk. My dog came along because it was too long and somewhat open-ended. And so there wasn't a really good way to dump her on anybody. And it worked out great. And we took Highway 50 across Nevada. I don't know if you know, Highway 50 is the loneliest road. Is it in the country or the world or whatever it is? It was called that by Life magazine many years ago, and they told people that the AAA and Life magazine said, don't take this highway.
In America,
okay. And of course now Nevada makes a tourist thing of it. You can actually get a little card and get it signed off on at different places along the route, which we didn't do that, but we did take the road and it was wonderful and it really was empty. Have you done it? It's really, I mean, there you could be like half an hour or an hour and not see any other cars. And we saw something, we would just stop. And then, a couple of times, a car came up behind us. And said, all right, we're on the highway. But they could just go around because there was nobody else on the road. And we stopped at something. Our first night, couple of nights, was at Cold Spring Station, which is in the middle of nowhere. And it's on the Pony Express route. I think Highway 50 was the Pony Express route. So it's not called a stop or a resort, which would be a very glorified word for this place. It was just nothing. There was a motel and a cafe and bar and an RV place. And that's it. And I thought there was a town called Cold Springs that was kind of just over a little rise. But no, that was it. And it was marvelous. And we went on to Moab and went to Arches National Monument and Dead Horse State Park. And we got a dog sitter for one day, and we went on a rafting trip down the Colorado. We went to Denver and visited with friends there. And then to Kansas and visited with friends in Lawrence, Kansas, which is near Kansas City. And they fell in love with my dog, which was very sweet. And they were not so much, they're not really dog people, but that didn't matter anyway. And then we went to Cedar Rapids, Iowa. A colleague had died, and that was, her funeral was then. And we didn't set out for that, but since we were there and we both liked and respected her, we went to that. And then we hightailed it back to Portland. My friend came, her name is Gyokuko Carlson. She's the retired co-abbot of the Dharma Rain Zen Center in Portland, which I commend to you should you ever be up in Portland. But at any rate, it was their 50th anniversary on June 1st. So from Cedar Rapids, we just took 80 to 84 and just got there and did that. And then I came home. And it was a wonderful trip. We usually drove only about 4 hours a day, sometimes more. And the openness of that country, I really do like high desert. And then when we hit Utah, it seemed like we crossed the border and boom, the rocks were red. I love the red rocks. And my heart just opened. It just felt like I spent a lot of time south of there, and near the Canyon de Chelly and so on, and Monument Valley. Anyway, it felt like coming home. It was wonderful. So whatever your joy is, don't forget to include it. Don't forget to refresh, recreate yourself, and then you can turn towards your zazen, turn towards your breath and your body with some lightness. I hope you always do it with some lightness. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we push too hard. It's really, really important to remember to enjoy your life. And then you can bring that joy to others. I said early on, you know, it seems to me that this living in this, you know, karmic world of bodies and preferences and thoughts and sensations and so on, at the same time that we have this intention to let go of greed, hate, and delusion. That seems to me that's a way of talking about zazen. And I just wanted to raise for you, you know, how do you define zazen? What is it for you? Online, you could just raise your hands, I think. Don't everybody leap up at once.
I'm sure that I don't know what zazen is.
Don't boast.
No. was the confession.
As much as any of us, you know what zazen is.
Nowadays, I'm on a kick to try to figure out the skandhas. You know, I've been doing this for some time, and I never really got into the skandhas. We don't talk about it too much in Zen, although it's right there in the Heart Sutra, dead center. But I never quite realized that. Anyway. I was at Reb's yesterday, and he said, among other things, a phrase I hadn't heard before, stop resisting infinity, or we can stop, or something like that. But resisting infinity, that's what I'm resisting.
Yeah, well, it's a way to talk about it. I mean, of course you can't define zazen, because nobody can define zazen. Though we have to talk about it anyway. You know, we say sometimes that every time I open my mouth, I make a mistake. So resisting infinity, resisting death, resisting emptiness. It's scary. It is scary. There have been people on Facebook, I guess, of teachers, some of them have said, I'm not afraid of death anymore. And I think to myself, that's not true. Right now, you don't feel it, but it's available to you. And so that's, I say sometimes, you know, can the gesture be this? And this, putting my hand, you know, if I do it here or I'm just talking to you about it, it's not, but doing that, this is frightening to me. It feels very vulnerable. And I mean vulnerable. And Mel makes a great distinction between vulnerable and openness. We say, I feel vulnerable. And it does, it implies that we feel vulnerable to something, vulnerable to an attack or something. Whereas if we're just open, we're not protecting ourselves. And I do feel a little vulnerable doing this. And it's hard for me right this minute to leave it out there. And I'm doing it anyway because I'm making a point. But I don't want to. And I'm not going anywhere now. But anyway, yeah. Stop resisting infinity is as good a way of saying it as any. But we do. But if you're willing, are you willing to be with how scary it is? That's what, you know, that's, and I've had times when my fear of death left. I told Mel that one time because it's been a koan for me. I mean, death has been conquered. And I told him, and he said, have you written your will? And I said, no. He said, write your will. And then a month later, I was waiting to see him in Doksan. And I realized, oops, I didn't start on my will. And I used to be a lawyer, so in my car there were legal pads. I went and grabbed the legal pad, and I started. And immediately, this gut-wrenching terror came up. And I learned, you know, oh. When I said that to him, I didn't feel it, but here it is. It's just, it's available. So I spent a lot of time with that fear. And it has not up right now. I have some sadness about friends who are actually dying with me now, but not that, not the fear. But I know it's there, and I think, we just keep practicing with it. And sometimes infinity is okay, and sometimes it's not. And I think that's true for everybody, including them. So.
Hello.
1, 2, yes.
Your talk is kind of timely for those of us who are in a study group here. We're studying a Song of the Trusting Mind, so. Which starts off, the way is not difficult. for those who hold no preferences.
Choosing, yeah.
Yeah. I, you know, as a former lawyer myself, I tend to like to control my life and everybody else's. And, you know, obviously there are difficult karmic things that we all have. But what I've noticed from my practice is there are things that I try to control that it really just doesn't matter much.
Yeah.
You know, and so we had Father's Day yesterday, and the kids wanted to know, do I want to go to this cafe or that cafe? And in the past, I would have said, well, I'll pick this one. But it's just food, you know, so it makes no difference to me. You pick it, and that's that. And so these things.
Well, let me tell you something. Yeah. It'll be complicated for you. You know, if I offer that kind of thing to somebody, part of the gift is letting them choose. And so putting it back on me puts a burden on me. And it's more generous of you next year.
Okay.
To go ahead and if they say which one would you like?
Right.
Pick one.
Okay. So, and then I have a friend, we'll get together every once in a while. And he might ask me something, and I sincerely say I really don't have a view on that. And he says, well, I want you to have a view. I want you to express it. So would my gift to be then to...
No, you don't know. No, it's different. Do you understand the difference of that distinction?
Yeah.
But you don't have to have a view if you don't have a view.
I just read Mel's book of edited Dharma talks.
Right.
I never met him, and I never had a chance to, but I had seen some of his YouTubes, and the lightness of him just struck me. You tell me if I'm misunderstood. I mean, I just felt a lightness in the way that he taught. So
sometimes,
yeah,
he wasn't mad at you.
Yeah,
he was tough on people that were his students and that he respected, that were his more senior students, and he would come down to Tassajara in the summer, say, you know, and people would say, oh, he's so wonderful. He's this so sweet, grandfatherly old man. He's just so sweet. I'm sitting there thinking, what are you talking about, the same guy? And his, those of us in my category, we talk about this, we laugh about it, that he could be quite tough. But there was a lightness. I mean, we were having difficulty for a few months. And I, every time I'd go into Doksan, he would greet me. It just seemed really open with a great smile, you know. And then I'd start telling him how it was wrong, and then we'd get into it. But that was a great teaching, that he met me fresh every time. So.
Thank you, Mary.
We have a question on Zoom.
Okay. Well, go ahead, and then I don't see the. Is there a hand up?
It's me.
Oh, Dana, okay. Go ahead. No, wait a second. You're next, after this person.
Okay, sorry.
So I thank you for your talk. I really appreciated both the focus of it and the range of it. It was really nice. And I've been on a couple of road trips recently too, so it was just nice to hear you. And I was sort of feeling like, oh gosh, you know, I'm gone all the time and I'm doing all this stuff, and so it was nice to hear you say, oh, you know, you should enjoy your life. You know, I know now you'll probably say, well, not too much, but you know, that was heartening. One of the things I notice about my practice right now is that I'm noticing things, and like Larry, I recently read Sojin Roshi's book, and was really, I actually haven't finished it yet, but one of the things I've incorporated in my practice is his this is it, you know, just kind of like, this is it, you know, so no matter what's going on in my life or in my practice, when I sit down, it's a way of just accepting whatever's happening without kind of striving to get somewhere else. You know, one of the things I noticed when I was driving on one of these recent trips was just driving through this. It was through Idaho. It's very gorgeous, vast open area, and just feeling a lot of gratitude just for so many different things. Mm-hmm. Just, you know, being on the road, having a car that took me there, you know, just, you know, all these different variety of things that came up. And then just a great sadness, which seemed kind of antithetical to the gratitude. I'm not quite sure how they're related or not, but you know, that's okay too. But just sort of the noticing of these things has been really helpful in my practice recently.
Keep it up.
Thanks.
Stop. Don't ask. Don't wonder why. Just feel it. Dana?
Hi, Mary. Can you guys hear me?
Yep.
Okay. Recently, first of all, I'm glad you're back and you're safe and you had such a great time and that you went down the river. I like thinking about you going down the river. recently, my brother came to stay. I've seen him 3 times this year, and it's been really great. He lives in Boulder, and he's a treasure in my life. I think I'm probably a big fan of his, maybe more than he is of me. But anyway, he came, and when he's around, everything is kind of, I feel really grounded and very happy, and we're more efficient, like things get done more, like our house is pulled together, everything just seems to make sense. And then I feel, and then the closer we get to him leaving, like I suffer because I'm sad that he's going to leave, but I don't know how to express it to him in a skillful way. And the word skillful I learned from you, skillful communication. So it might be our ancient tangled karma or whatever, but we're never really good at feelings. And when I say we, I mean me. So we're getting ready for him to leave with, like, you know, pending, you know, within 4 hours or something. And I'm welling up, and I've been crying a little bit about it out of his reach. And I finally said something to him that wasn't very skillful, but oddly enough, kind of had anger in it. It was almost like, what are you doing to me that you're leaving, in a way, kind of, right? And he said, you, it's always about you. What do you mean? I'm the one that's getting on my motorcycle and I'm going to be riding to Boulder. And I thought, I'm not being very skillful here. And I let it kind of have some space. And later we were on the couch, he was fixing to go. And I said, you know, I don't think I was very skillful when I said that before. What I meant to say is that I really love you. I love you, and I'm going to miss you, and I'm so glad that you've been here. And there was like this space of time, and there was nothing said, and yet everything was said. And then he said something that he could have said that, you know, we're not squishy and huggy, you know. But let's say things were forgiven and accepted, and not a lot of words needed to be said, but I felt better, and I think he felt better. And I don't know if it's a fruit of practice, but I do know it's a word that I learned from you that you can kind of reframe and kind of apologize and kind of start again. And I had the courage to do it, and I was glad that I did. And I guess that's what I want to share. And a lot of it was a lot of the story I'm telling you, because it feels like it came from my practice, but it wasn't something that, you know, that I thought I would ever get better at doing. You know what I mean?
Yep. Thank you. Definitely a fruit of practice.
Yeah.
Thank you.